Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, if John McCain keeps saying my friends all the time, I'm going to have to... Well, I'll continue to say. I've been saying it for 6 years. Anyhow, welcome to our program. Last night, West Virginia, those of you who listened to our program yesterday know it wasn't a best-of show, and no, I don't think I spent more than 5 minutes on the West Virginia primary in the entire program, in part because I personally, and I suspect many of you are experiencing a certain amount of election fatigue, as it were, and in part, or primary fatigue or whatever, we got it. We know what's going on, and we've heard all the talking heads and all the pontification to the point of. And in part because it was, we pretty much knew how it was going to come out, and in fact, that's how it did come out. It was about a blowout, a 2-1 victory by Hillary Clinton over Barack Obama. In fact, we had David Sirota on earlier in the week talking about why this would be, suggesting that this fell into what he has identified as this race chasm, is his phrase. Cities that have more than 6% and fewer than 17% African-American population. And, where there's not enough African-Americans to balance out the white racist vote on the one hand, but there are enough to stir up the white racists, essentially, as it were. And that it may be that this is just an area that isn't going to work for Barack Obama. On the other hand, it may be that it has nothing to do with Barack Obama. It may be that this was not racial politics at all. It may be that Hillary Clinton worked her heart out in West Virginia. She was there. Bill was there. Chelsea was there. They just danced their hearts out. And she did a very, very good job of portraying herself as basically the NASCAR candidate, as the down-home average person candidate. It was marvelous campaigning, good marketing, and she won a victory. So, very significant victory. But I think the really significant victory yesterday was not to diminish Senator Clinton's win, but that was expected. This one wasn't. And this was down in Mississippi. This was the ad that the Republicans were running against the Democrat who was running in this race in Mississippi.
I'm Greg Davis, and I approve this message.
Travis Childers, endorsed by liberal Barack Obama.
Obama says Childers will put progress before politics. But when Obama's pastor cursed America, blaming us for 9/11, Childers said nothing. When Obama ridiculed rural folks for clinging to guns and religion, Childers said nothing. Travis Childers, he took Obama's endorsement over our conservative values. Conservatives just can't trust Travis Childers.
Yeah, well, apparently conservatives decided that they really didn't care about Reverend Wright. They really didn't care about Barack Obama's they kind of liked, apparently, the fact that Barack Obama was associated with Travis Childers, and Travis Childers refused to disavow Barack Obama. And so, he won by 8 points. This is not insignificant. He won by 8 points. And this is in a deeply conservative district. Now, let's acknowledge Childers was representing himself as the guy who's anti-abortion and in favor of gun rights. But that's pretty much everybody in Mississippi. I mean, that's just the way it goes. So here you have this deeply conservative district. And Bush, by the way, carried 63% of the vote in this district in 2004. And yet a Democrat just won. And there are 110 other Republican-held seats less conservative than this one. I mean, this election, this 2008 election, could be a blowout down ticket, and it's certainly looking this way. A question, two things that I think are significant that came out of yesterday's victory by Hillary Clinton in West Virginia, and it's going to follow up with Kentucky, and that is, number one, is this, as some wags have suggested, some folks have said, well, really, she's running for 2012. And is that conceivably the case, that she's running for 2012? I think that we will find out, assuming that she's not the nominee, which is a reasonable assumption, but not necessarily a safe assumption at this point. But assuming that she's not the nominee, well, I think we'll find out as we, particularly in October and November, September, October, November, as we get up to the campaign to, and we watch to see to what extent Hillary and Bill Clinton are out there campaigning for Barack Obama. As Howard Dean said a while ago, and as I've said many times, the really important person in this Clinton-Obama race is not going to be the winner. It's going to be the loser. The loser is going to decide who, more than the winner, frankly, in my opinion, who's going to be the next president of the United States. So, number one, is she running for 2012? And the other was something that I thought was you know, very interesting, was this website, voteboth.com. And the whole point of this website, voteboth.com, is there's apparently it's put together by a group of Clinton supporters. And it is arguing strongly in favor of this dream ticket of Obama and Clinton, or Clinton and Obama, as the case may be. So would Hillary Clinton accept the VP spot if it was offered? Is the Obama camp going to offer it? If not, who else should they consider for VP, assuming that Obama is the candidate? If Obama runs without Hillary on the ticket in 2008 and wins, will Hillary run in 2012? Would she challenge her own party? I don't think so. I frankly don't think so. But I know that there are some out there who strongly believe that she's planning on running in 2012, whether he wins or not. And what kind of precedent would that set? How has it happened? Is she really willing to challenge a sitting president from her own party? Could she run as an independent in 2012? Again, I consider that, frankly, impossible. But there are some who are suggesting that that would happen. And with regard to West Virginia, going back to that whole thing with West Virginia, again, there are folks who are running around going, oh, it's the racist vote. I mean, there was the Saturday Night Live skit that, you know, where they're making fun of Hillary Clinton and saying, you know, my voters are racists. But I suspect, my personal take on this is that it was more about class than it was about race. That John Kerry, when he was doing his trying to be presidential best, he was doing his Boston Brahmin best, or some might say worst, you know, wearing a suit and standing up straight and not just that, those things, obviously, but, you know, he had that bearing, that kind of regal bearing about him. If John Kerry had been running against Hillary Clinton in West Virginia, would she have beat him by exactly the same margin as she beat Barack Obama, or within a few points of it? I suspect so. I think that would have been the case. And I mean, there's no way to know, because this is the first primary in a long time that's gone so far that West Virginia actually gets to vote, and it's a contested election. It's a big deal. But I suspect that Hillary Clinton would have beat him. So, you know, the question, does yesterday's primary, I mean, there's a whole bunch of questions that are raised by this. Does yesterday's primary prove that extreme racism is still alive and well in America, and so strong that it can influence an election? Obviously, it's alive and well. Is it strong enough to influence an election? Is it strong enough to be a major influencer of elections? And my suspicion is no. I think that we're past that, just like sexism and misogyny. Is that? No, I think that we're past that, although these things are still here and very real. Is Hillary Clinton planning this run for 2012? Charles Hurt, writing in the New York Post today, says, this Dateline Charleston, West Virginia, he says, with no hope of winning her party's nomination, Hillary is running the clock out by laying the foundation for her political future circa 2012. As she seems to float in and out of reality in the campaign trail, so easy to dismiss her as delusional, she is not, says Charles Hurt. For many years, the Clintons have dined on opponents who mistakenly dismissed them. As with her husband, there is always a method to her madness. By sticking with it against all odds, Clinton becomes the patron saint of lost causes, of never giving up. And thus it is no coincidence that she chose a crucial swing state in which to fight her heart out against these insurmountable odds long after everyone had dismissed her. After last night's victory, she's free to quit, or perhaps after Kentucky. And he goes on to say, as usual, the Clintons are seen far around the next corner. She expects Obama to lose in November precisely because of the weaknesses that she exposed in this primary. He'll have trouble winning blue-collar Democrats in swing states. That opens the door to her return in 4 years as the party's prodigal daughter, saying, as you recall, my worst fears came true. Now it's my turn. Was Charles Hurt right? Should we be looking at this Hillary Obama ticket? Or does that destroy everything that Obama stands for? So a lot of questions on the table. Also, we're going to be running a contest for a signed copy of Cracking the Code today for the best entry in our producer Sean Taylor's opinion on our blog at TomHartmann.com, today's show blog. So a lot going on. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartmann.
By the way, in the second hour of our program, we're going to get into this whole prescription pill epidemic in the United States. In our third hour, Daisha Ray is going to drop by for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. She is a former sex worker and edits the Village Voice sexuality blog, Naked City. We'll be talking about sex workers in America. And Larry Scott from VA Watchdog is going to be dropping by at the very end of our show today. So a lot going on. Let me just clarify my take on what's going on with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in this race and why Hillary is staying in this race, even though the numbers look bad. I think that my personal take on this is that she is staying in this race because she still thinks that there is a small chance that she could be the nominee, that either A, he could blow up, or B, that the superdelegates could say, hey, look at this. Look at what happened with West Virginia, for example, in Kentucky. Maybe America isn't ready for an African-American president, or maybe America just isn't ready for him, whatever, that she thinks that there is some possibility that she could win. Hillary is running in 2012 right now theory is not one that I subscribe to at the moment. I frankly believe that A, we should take people at their word. We should assume that what they say is actually true until or unless proven otherwise. And B, that actions speak louder than words. And so far, what she's been saying has been quite consistent. As long as there's a chance that she might win, she's going to stay in the race, and she has every right to. And in fact, Barack Obama has defended her right to stay in the race. And I think that in many ways, the negatives to the party, the people who are becoming polarized and staking out positions and saying, no, I'll even vote for John McCain, blah, 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 blah. I think that is massively outweighed by the new people who are coming into the party as a result of this being dragged out. To the extent that Rush Limbaugh thinks that he's doing something wonderful with Operation Chaos and whatever. And frankly, I don't think that he's played that big a role in this. I think there's a couple of states where perhaps he could have influenced it, but I don't think he's playing that, Indiana being one of them, but I don't think he's playing that big a role in it. But to the extent that he thinks that this is a wonderful thing that the Democratic nomination process has dragged out this long, I think he's wrong. I think this has been a good thing for the Democratic Party. I think it's been a good thing for democracy in America. I think it's been a good thing for political discourse. I think that, we only have, 3 weeks left? And, yeah, as I said, in the earlier segment, a lot of us are experiencing, I think, to at a certain point, primary fatigue, but it's going to be resolved. And then if Hillary and Bill Clinton do aggressively and enthusiastically endorse and campaign for Barack Obama, assuming that he's the nominee, then I will say I was right. She is not running for 2012. She was not running for 2012, and that whole meme, that whole theory is nonsense. On the other hand, if they don't campaign for him, assuming that he's the nominee, then I'll be scratching my head going, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I need to reconsider. But, I don't think that, trying to figure out what she's thinking or where she's going with this, I don't think that that's as important as just watching what's being done, watching, listening to what's being said. And frankly, what I'm hearing from her is more and more conciliatory language, and by and large from Barack Obama all along, more and more conciliatory language, bringing the nation together language. I think it's a good thing. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And TomHartmann.com, our website, by the way, and AirAmerica.com, of course, for Air America's website. Dan in Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Dan.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
All right. My question.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that Barack wins the nomination for the Democratic Party. And what is the possibility or legality of Hillary Clinton running in the general election under a different party or as an independent?
It's entirely legal. I mean, you know, Joe Lieberman demonstrated the viability of that. The probability of it happening, I say, is zero or less than zero. She and Bill, they would be burning so many bridges. They would be blowing up so many future opportunities, both inside and outside of politics. I don't think that there's any chance that they would do that. I know, you know, people have asked the question, but not a chance. Not a chance. Sharon in West Virginia. Hey, you have a catbird seat there. What are your thoughts on West Virginia?
Well, I think people are making way too much out of it. I heard here within the last year, public radio did a segment about which state was the most demographically like the rest of the country, and that's Illinois. And West Virginia is the least typical state in terms of, you know, just demographics, age, proportion of rural. I think we're making way too much of it. From where I sit in north central West Virginia, from what I could hear around me, I live in a Republican county. It's weird, but I do. And there is an element of racism, but I just don't think that ultimately it's going to make any difference. I mean, I'm for Obama, but even if Hillary does get the nomination, and I will support her, the state's going to go for McCain.
Yeah. Well, but that's a state that went for Bill Clinton in 92 and 96, didn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, the Bush people have been so successful in doing this God, guns, and gays thing that, you know, I don't know that even up to this point if that can be overcome.
But the number of people who voted in yesterday's primary in West Virginia was larger than the number, and this is a primary election, was larger than the number of people who voted for John Kerry in 2004.
Well,
that's a really good sign in my mind.
I'm an Obama supporter, but I will vote for Hillary. I might even get out there and work for her a little bit, but...
I just don't
see it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Sharon.
Love the show.
Thank you. Thank
Bye.
You. Thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening there in West Virginia and Sirius. Oh, my. We will continue with your thoughts on this and mine at 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And, of course, don't forget our contest for Sean's favorite comment on our blog today.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Anybody can become president in the United States. Here we are achieving the dream of this nation. We haven't quite achieved it yet, but we're getting damn close. I think it's a marvelous thing. Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program, the most labor-friendly, labor-supported program in all of radio. Tom Hartmann Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. Proud to be supported by the Teamsters. And proud to support the Teamsters. It's time for change in Washington. You can find out more at Teamster.org. That's singular. Teamster.org. And by the way, on Friday, day after tomorrow, I will be in Chicago. We'll be flying out there tomorrow after I get off the air. And Friday night, I'll be at the Frugal Muse Bookstore. That's at 7 p.m. at the corner of the southeast corner, 75th and Lamont Road in Darien, in suburban Chicago. And on Saturday, I'll be keynoting the Chicago Green Festival from the main stage on Saturday at 1 o'clock. And then in June, on June 23rd, we'll be broadcasting our show for a week live from the studios of Danish National Radio, to find out, you know, what's going on in Denmark? Why are they the happiest people in the world? American conservatives notwithstanding, according to their own studies, but in any case. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Charlie in Lawrence, Kansas. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Hey, how's it going there, Tom?
Fine.
Hey, I just wanted to talk to you a couple of things about West Virginia. As I was watching these numbers come in last night, you know, they say that only 2 out of 10 people that were polled, and granted that they could have been some hesitation there, but 2 out of 10 were people that said that there was race made a difference to them.
Right.
So that's about 20%, right?
Yeah, one-fifth.
But, I mean, take the flip side of that and say how many, you know, with the blacks voting 90% for Obama, it just seems like there's something that's not being spoken because the media might be a little bit worried about how they're going to be, you know, what's it going to look like if they start questioning that number.
Yeah, you know, there's a subtle subtext to this, and in some ways it's not so subtle, and you find it in the media unspoken, and I get a lot of email where it's explicitly spoken. And that is that why is it racist for a white person to say that they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton because of her race, and it's not racist for a black person to say that they're going to vote for Barack Obama because of his race? And at a certain level, it can be racist on both sides. And I think that we all have to acknowledge that. On the other hand, there, for the same reason that many women are not just supporting Hillary because they agree with all of her positions, but are also enthusiastic about the fact that a woman is running. And many African Americans are supporting Barack Obama, not just because of his positions, but also because, hey, it's an African American, the first real shot at the presidency. I think that when, and not being a member of an oppressed minority myself, I don't have the authority to speak of this, but, you know, a reasonable observer of American life throughout my life and the American political life, that if somebody is African American or if they're female or if they're gay or if they're part of some other minority that has traditionally been oppressed by white males in the United States, and even some religious groups, you know, Catholics, for example, who have felt the oppression of WASPs, you know, seriously, I mean, big time in the 19th century, certainly in the United States, there are groups where to say, yeah, this guy is part of my group, and I'm excited about that, and I'm enthusiastic about that. That's not the only reason I'm voting for him, but it's a piece of it, and it would be a lie to deny that. That is not, in my opinion, racist or genderish-ist or religious-ist or whatever. You know, the Catholics who voted for John Kennedy. That's just acknowledging another piece of the whole realm of enthusiasm. Does that make sense?
I can agree with you, and I can follow that sort of having pride that you want to, that pride goes out in the bun. But see, the media brings it up about,
well,
when she makes any question, but they don't bring it up. They don't speak to it that way. They're accusing her of, anytime she mentions that fact that, you know, if you pull that 90% block out from Obama and split it in half, where would he be? So, and then to mention, but,
yeah.
You know, I'm Latino, and I saw Richardson run. And I really didn't run to him and say, hey, you know, I mean, I was proud that there was at least a Latino running, but I voted for him, you know, really, almost, I can say, almost definitely I wouldn't have because he just didn't appeal to me. But I was going to tell you one other thing. The Hillary is running, and a lot of people are giving her all kinds of questions as to why she's running and on and on. But, you know, I think that Hillary loves this country, and I really believe that. I believe she's given her whole life to this.
I agree.
She's given this whole life. And she knows.
And I think she loves public service. I think she loves the idea of being able to change things for the better and representing people.
Yeah, I really do. I think, and that's why she's running, because I think she believes that she really is the stronger candidate. I think she sees Swift Boat 08 coming on board with Reverend Wright. Yeah. I think she really knows we have a chance of losing.
Yeah, well, it may be. And Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Although, I think, you know, as you, the evidence, I mean, this was the first Republican, serious Republican attack ad of this season. And, I mean, this is so important. Let us not forget. This ad saturated the airwaves down in Mississippi.
I'm Greg Davis, and I approve this message.
For Republican Greg Davis.
Endorsed by liberal Barack Obama. Obama says Childers will put progress before politics. But when Obama's pastor cursed America, blaming us for 9/11, Childers said nothing. When Obama ridiculed rural folks for clinging to guns and religion, Childers said nothing. Travis Childers, he took Obama's endorsement over our conservative values. Conservatives just can't trust Travis Childers.
And in fact, in one of the most conservative districts in the United States, there's 110 Republicans in the House of Representatives representing districts that are less conservative than this district. Travis Childers, the Democrat, who was the victim of that attack ad, tying him to Barack Obama and Reverend Wright, won by 8 points yesterday. So, I think that we really have to keep that in mind. Jamie in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jamie, what's up? Jamie, you are on the air. I am not
Hello?
Hearing. Yeah, Jamie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. The only question I have to say is the people in the country that you listen to over and over again, women go, well, we just want to see a woman in the White House, will be resolved if Barack Obama picks a strong candidate, female candidate from as in a governor or whatever, like Claire McCaskill or the governor from
Sibelius.
Kansas.
Yeah.
And everybody will say, Hillary who? And that's where this whole problem falls away.
See, Jamie, that thinking, I mean, that's that distinction that I was trying to make between racism and racial enthusiasm, as it were, genderism and gender enthusiasm. I think that there are a lot of women who are saying that they like Hillary Clinton on all these issues, and the fact that she's a woman is a big plus. And there's a small minority of women who are saying, yes, they're going to go for Hillary Clinton simply because she's a woman and any woman would be fine. Just like there's a small minority of African Americans who are saying, hey, you know, he's an African American, or at least his father was, and so we'll vote for him. And that's the wrong reason. And I think that for Barack Obama to say, okay, I'm going to pick a vice presidential candidate to pander to women, is as big a mistake as thinking that African Americans, that his candidacy is a pander to African Americans. It is not. It is not. And in fact, let us not forget that before most African Americans knew very much about Barack Obama's positions on the issues, Hillary Clinton had more support than he did in the African American community in the polls just a year ago when he was running, even after the first couple of debates. So I am not, don't think it's appropriate to be going there. Charlie in Newport News, Virginia. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Tom. How are you? As a quick sidebar, my father was probably the role model for Archie Bunker character.
Okay.
And as right-wing as they can get, but he, being an Irish Catholic, was in the tank for JFK, so I understand identity politics.
Yeah, and identity politics can, you know, there's a light side and a dark side to it, as it were, to use a metaphor that I know would make Malcolm X cringe, but nonetheless, this is one of my people, and everything else is there. That's a good thing. Hey, this is one of my people. Screw everything else. I'm just voting, you know, my race or my gender or my, you know, whatever. That's wrong.
Right. But anyway, my anger has tempered due to the time on hold and your last discussion, because I was so angry, almost yelling at my radio when you were reading that piece to open the show.
Oh, about 2012?
I don't know who that guy was that you were quoting. But
it's
you know
in today's New York Post. I mean, it's like a million people are reading this thing, and it's all over the Internet. And that's my point, is that that's one of the major buzzes that is out there. And I think that that is just as destructive, frankly, to the whole discourse. I think that's just as destructive as the attempts to play, you know, as the media playing Reverend Wright over and over and over again and trying to make Barack Obama, you know, emphasize his African-Americanness, or playing that unfortunate clip of Hillary Clinton where she said white voters over and over and over again. That was, you know, in my opinion, I don't think that she sat down and said, oh, I'm going to drop this in. I mean, give me a break.
Because it was, Tom. I'm sitting there. It's all this psychoanalyzing, psychobabble that goes on inside the mind of villain Hillary Clinton. You know what? She's running for president because, one, Barack Obama has not achieved the necessary numbers, whether it's the with or without the Michigan-Florida numbers. And, two, she thinks, and I agree with her, she's going to be the better president and the better commander-in-chief. That's why she's running. She's not running for any of this other psychoanalytical stuff.
I agree with you, and she has every right to.
And the language that was in that piece, Tom, delusional and whatever other diatribes were in there.
Well, it was quoting
so
the media. I mean,
to the former first lady, just drives me nuts.
I agree with you, Charlie. It was quoting, and thank you for the call. It was quoting the media pundits who are saying, "Well, you know, she's delusional." I don't think she's delusional. These same people, by the way, I don't recall them attacking Mike Huckabee for staying in the race, even though it was pretty clear that he wasn't going to win. 45 minutes past the hour.
is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
And this is, I've seen the statistic elsewhere. This is solid stuff. Let's also keep in mind that Barack Obama got 91,000 votes, 91,663 votes yesterday. That was 26% of the Democratic vote. But look at just the raw number, 91,000 votes in West Virginia. John McCain winning the Republican primary with only 76% of the vote, by the way, got 89,000 votes. So Barack Obama yesterday got more votes in West Virginia than John McCain did. Now, granted, the Republican contest was not all that hot, but nonetheless, I find that fascinating. I got an entire board here full of calls. As usual, we're just totally slammed, and we've got 5 minutes, I think, less than 6 minutes left in the segment. So I'm going to ask you to keep your comments really short. I'll keep my answers really short, and let's just get through some of this stuff here. 866-303-2270, George in Naperville, Illinois. Hey, George, what's up?
Well, thanks for taking my call. Quick question about your book signing down the street from me on Friday. A lot of people around here are trying to plan their trip either there or to Chicago, to the Green Fest. Are you going to give a little rant before the book signing?
Yes.
Or after?
Yeah, that's my plan. Assuming the bookstore will allow me to do it. Usually they do, and that's to talk for about an hour, and then half hour to an hour, and then sign books for an hour or so.
Well, that'll be fantastic. And by the way, your comment about Rush Limbaugh's effect in Indiana, don't underestimate your effect either. I spent half my time in South Bend, and I heard three people streaming you in three separate offices during Monday and Tuesday of the week of the primaries.
Oh, that's great to hear. Well, thank you very much, George.
See
and thanks
Friday.
A lot for the call. We'll see you on Friday. Yep. Kari in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Is it Kari or Kerry?
Yeah, good afternoon. Two quick things. One is I like what you said about the amount of votes that Brock had. People forget that West Virginia only has 94.9% Caucasian, and everybody else makes up the rest.
Yeah.
So for him to get 91,000 votes there isn't a small feat. The second,
especially when that's 2,000 votes more than John McCain got.
Exactly. The second thing is, you were talking earlier about whether it's racist for black people to vote for Barack and racist for white people to vote for Hillary. Well,
if they do it purely on the basis of race.
You're right, just because of the race. Well, the thing that people do forget is that knowing who Hillary was, she had the majority of the black vote. But before, and that was before people had a chance to actually listen to him, and before she started talking and actually stumbling over herself.
But see, I think it was more that they started listening to him, and I think what this says is that the African American vote in the United States, by and large, is an issues-based vote. It is not a race-based vote, because Hillary Clinton, in the beginning of this battle, everybody, could look at all of them standing up there and go, yeah, Barack Obama, that guy is at least part African American, or he's African American, he's part African, and yet the majority of the African American community in the United States was supporting Hillary Clinton early on. When everything that the only thing that people had to do was look, the African Americans were supporting Hillary Clinton because they knew her positions. When they got to know his positions, they started supporting him. That says to me that they're not voting based on race.
And that's the thing. I myself am an African American, and most of me and my friends actually were for Hillary Clinton. But after we started listening to what he was saying, and after we started listening to her, and her things like, I didn't support NAFTA before, but then afterwards it came out, well, I sort of did. It's shifted, and her stumbling over herself and us listening to what he actually was offering and not really stumbling over himself, but them trying to put other people's words as his, sort of made you gravitate towards him.
Yeah, she didn't do herself any favor with the whole Bosnia thing and whatnot, but yeah, good point. Kari, thanks a lot for the call. David in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, David.
Hello, yeah, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for taking my
You're
call.
You're welcome. Your point.
Yeah, I was wondering why it's so she was a presumptuous nominee when she first started, and all of a sudden things started to change. to go negative towards her, and then all of a sudden she's pushing negativity towards Obama to try to not to get him the nomination for the President of the United States. And I believe this is a historical, even though he's a black man, that I'm a white man. I think it's pretty good that America's seeing the light kind of way, where the black Americans were so suppressed in America for over, you know, 60, 80 years.
Try 400 years. But, yeah, no, your point is well taken. Thank you very much, David, for making it. Jeff in Orange County, California, excuse me, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, first of all, I think she's very divisive, letting Geraldine Ferraro make her racist comments. And
as soon as Geraldine Ferraro said that, she was toast. She was out.
Good, but and then also during the ABC debate with Stephanopoulos, she was encouraging all the Reverend Wright commentary, and you know, she's and 20%.
That was fairly evident, Jeff. But I don't think that she was doing that for race. I think she was simply doing that because she thought that this is something that was going to hurt her opponent.
Any cost. I just want to say one thing. I think Bill Richardson would be a fantastic vice presidential pick for Barack.
I absolutely agree with you. I think he, for a whole, not just for all the political reasons, but also because he's a good man and he's a good candidate. Sheldon, thanks for the call. Sheldon in Boca Raton, Florida, listening to Wins. Hey, Sheldon.
Yes, Tom. Thanks for my call. One thing. The other day you said that our wars were racist. And
I said what? I'm sorry?
You said that America's wars were racist.
I said that what has happened in most of our wars is that racism has emerged as one of the things that we have used to rally people. I understand. You know, this happens in every war. This happens in every nation.
You have to do it, because if you don't, you're looking at your enemy as a human being.
That's right.
And you're less apt to kill them.
That's right. And that's the horror of war. I mean, we have to acknowledge war is legalized mass murder. And in order to get average people, normal people, people who are not sociopaths and murderers, to actually kill other people, you have to dehumanize those other people first. And
that's my point.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you said it very well, Sheldon. Thank you. And it's a horrible and terrible thing. And that's that's why war is the ultimate crime. That's why, you know, crimes against humanity, war, that's why the Nuremberg Tribunal, you know, was all about the war, the preemptive war. This is why the war that George Bush did with Iraq for, in my opinion, purely political reasons. I think that the war against Iraq and the ongoing occupation, but I think they thought the war was going to be resolved in a matter of a couple of months, and they did it for political, for the 2002 and the 2004 elections. And, yeah, the worst of all reasons to organize legalized slaughter.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, could it be that the biggest problem in America, or one of the biggest crises that we face, is not a crisis of who's going to be president or not, although that's going to be a big one, or who's going to be on the Supreme Court, that's going to be defined by that, but by how many of us are soma'd out? You'll recall Aldous Huxley, I think it was Brave New World, was his book where he talked about the drug Soma that the government was routinely dispensing to everybody. If you go back and read Alexis de Tocqueville's 1836 classic Democracy in America, he has this chapter about, toward the end, I think the title of the chapter was Words to the Effect of What American Democracy Has to Fear. And he talks about the numbing, the gradual numbing of Americans. What if it's happening pharmaceutically? There's some really interesting studies that have just come out that I think, frankly, should raise a lot of alarm bells for all of us. And I just wanted to briefly share with you some of my experiences with these and my perspective on it. First of all, this from the Associated Press, Linda Johnson, the AP business writer. For the first time, it appears that more than half of all insured Americans are taking prescription medications regularly. Now, most of these are for chronic health problems. The numbers are gathered by Medco Health Solutions, which is a health insurance company that covers about a fifth of insured Americans. Half of all insured Americans taking medication, number one. Number two, this from the Newhouse News Service by Robert Cohen. The article entitled Surge in Antidepressant Medications or Prescriptions touches off a debate. The most widely prescribed drugs in America are not for pain or cholesterol management or heartburn or hypertension. They're for depression. 232.7 million prescriptions for antidepressants were written by doctors last year. That's an increase of 25 million since 2003. And Charles Barber has a new book out about this called Comfortably Numb, How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation. There's another interesting study, or an interesting article, written by Jonel Alekia, the health writer at MSNBC, titled Without TV Ads, Restless Legs May Take a Hike, pointing out that these designer disorders that we have, that while this drug that was Repinerol hydrochloride, which was originally developed for Parkinson's disease, and they found it caused people whose legs were twitching a little bit, or even a lot, to stop twitching. In fact, everything stopped twitching. They started marketing this stuff once it was under patent, and they could make a lot of money on it, started marketing this stuff like crazy. You know, do you have restless leg syndrome? And it turns out that in the studies that they did where they compared this drug, you know, looking for efficacy and safety, where they compared this drug against a placebo, against a sugar pill, and people didn't know which they were getting, 35% of the people who were taking this drug dropped out of the study because of the side effects. Side effects that include things like compulsive gambling, compulsive sexual promiscuity, or falling asleep while driving. I mean, these are literally life-threatening, promiscuity, AIDS, falling asleep while driving, life-threatening side effects. And yet this drug was aggressively marketed. Now it has gone, in fact, within a year, sales of Requip, or if that's how it's pronounced, had doubled, climbing from $165 million in 2005 to nearly $330 million in 2006. So you can see that investing a few million dollars in TV advertising for pharmaceuticals produces big returns. By last year, nearly 4.4 million prescriptions were written for the drug, with sales of nearly $491 million. That's up from $165 million. Back in 2005, before they started this aggressive marketing program. But now the drug is going generic. So you probably won't see ads for it anymore. And the sales will probably start to fall off. And frankly, for folks who are experiencing restless leg syndrome, there's a fair body of evidence that this may be associated actually with calcium deficiency, and taking some Tums or taking calcium supplements and walking every day simply solves the problem, or at least for many people. Not to play Dr. Dina Dell here, I'm not trying to do that, but, at what point do we say, hey, wait a minute, you know, it's too many drugs? My wife, Louise, back a decade ago, made a living, part of what she did was as a life coach for adults with attention deficit disorder, primarily, you know, focusing, her practice focused on entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, who were struggling with their ADHD, and with couples who were in crisis as a consequence of one of the members of the couple having ADHD. And she had a very, very successful practice. And the startling thing was the number of people who came to her who had originally gone in to see a physician for ADHD, got, you know, one of the stimulant drugs, typically, you know, Ritalin, something like that. Couldn't sleep, ended up getting a drug for sleeping. Then they were having panic attacks because if you take the sleeping drugs day after day after day, they start causing anxiety during the daytime. So then they got put on SSRIs on the Prozac type drugs for the anxiety. And then they were finding that they were in many cases basically addicted to a half a dozen or more drugs. And just, you know, helping these people detox or watching them or walking them through the process of detoxing, it was a pretty amazing thing. With these cholesterol-reducing drugs, a member of my family was taking one of these Lipitor family drugs, these statin drugs, and for high cholesterol, and started experiencing the classic side effect of excruciating pain in his legs. He stopped taking the drug and started taking Chinese herbs, and his blood pressure went down and his cholesterol went down even more than when he was taking the statin drug, and all the side effects went away. Now, obviously, these are just, you know, purely anecdotal studies, and I'm not here to promote the agenda of anybody who's anti-medication. I am personally not anti-medication. There are times when a lot of these medications are very useful. But have we gone way over the edge? You look at the number of kids who have been involved in school shootings who were on SSRI drugs, on the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. It's incredible. I remember in 1978, Louise and I started the New England-Salem Children's Village. It's a community residential treatment facility for severely emotionally disturbed or abused kids. And we took the kids who couldn't make it in foster care, who couldn't make it in any other part of the system, and if they didn't make it in our program, the next stop was either the children's jail or the psychiatric hospital. And I'm proud to say that in the 4 years I ran that program, we only had two kids who couldn't make it. But nonetheless, back in 78 through 83, very rarely when we were doing intake on these kids, very rarely did we have kids coming in with psychiatric medications associated with them. They had, you know, severe abuse. There was dysfunctions in families. I mean, just, you know, terrible, terrible situations. I remember, you know, one of the first kids I did intake on was the daughter of her father, of her sister by her father. I mean, it was just, you see these horrible situations. But very rarely were the drugs associated with them. I'm still on the board of that organization. In fact, up until last year, I was president of the board. And here 30 years later. And virtually all of the kids who are being referred into our program, and you can see the website for it, salemchildrensvillage.org, virtually all of the kids coming into the program now are coming with prescriptions. And some of them are coming with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 prescriptions. It is just absolutely incredible. I, you know, who's ADD out here? I'll raise my hand and say, I'm a member of that club or that tribe or whatever you want to call it. And I'll tell you, I was saved by Sputnik. I was in first grade in 1956 when Sputnik went up, or 57, second grade, I forget which it was. And when Sputnik went up, Eisenhower got totally freaked out. And he said, we've got to do something. We've got to identify the smart kids out there and move them along as fast as they can. And I was really fortunate that I was one of two kids in my class who was pulled out and put into an accelerated education program where I could learn pretty much anything I wanted as fast as I wanted for the next five or six years. And the result of that was a couple of years of foreign language, a couple of years of Latin. I could do math through trig by the time I was in sixth grade. I was reading at a college level. When I was 14, I got a summer scholarship to Michigan State University. All as a result of that, within 5 years, that program was gone. The Vietnam War had started up, you know, by the time the 60s came along, by the late 60s, or the mid 60s, all that money for education, all that money for education that had been going to gifted kids was instead going to the war in Vietnam. And my youngest brother, who is every bit as smart as I am and probably smarter, he was diagnosed as, oh, look at this kid, he's hyperactive. Well, I was just as hyperactive, but I could learn anything I wanted. I didn't have to sit quietly all day long in the classroom. I was saved by Sputnik. Are we over-medicating our kids? Are we over-medicating our society? Are we damaging ourselves? Are we becoming a society of soma numbed out? And maybe this is the reason why there's not people out in the streets. Because 10% of us, 10% of adults in America are on psychiatric medication right now. Half of all Americans are regularly taking prescription medication, all insured Americans. Have we gone past a point of rational use of these things? Are we is this our Valley of the Dolls moment? Back in the 60s, when that book came out, Valley of the Dolls, I would say half the mothers of the kids that I knew were on Valium. It was so popular back in the early 60s. And all these women were getting addicted to it, these housewives, you know, housewife heroin. Are we there again?
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Got a headache. I've got some strange disease. Don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Progenitorivox. It's made by Squab Merle. It's a life-enhancing miracle. But there are some things you should know.
It may cause constipation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations. But it's worth it for the drugs I need. My disease may not be fatal, but I can ease my fears by taking two $12 pills each day for 50 years. They've spent billions to convince me, so now I realize. Protein, a Toradox, beef diet, and exercise. I've got insurance.
Oh, my. 22 minutes past the hour. Yeah, half of all Americans with insurance are on Provenitoratox or something similar to it. And what does that mean for this country? What does that mean for this country? I am frankly a little, I'm frankly a lot concerned about this. I've seen it with friends. I've seen it with family. I've, as I said, I see it with the kids who are coming through our program, coming into our program in New Hampshire. Also, the school that we started there 10 years ago, the Hunter School, as in Hunter in a Farmer's World. In my opinion, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, ADHD, is actually not a disease per se, but it is a context disorder. That if somebody, the three principal characteristics of ADHD are, number one, distractibility. You know, the kid is supposed to be listening to the teacher, but he's noticing the fly walking across the ceiling, or the guy outside mowing the lawn. Number two, impulsivity, making quick decisions. In other words, he speaks out or she speaks out, interrupts people, you know, without thinking or without actually having the control to the self-control not to interrupt or to make quick decisions. And number three, a desire for high levels of stimulation, which translates very often into risk-taking behavior. That's the three-legged stool upon which rests the diagnosis of attention deficit disorder. And my first book on this topic, which I wrote back in 1992, called ADD, A Different Perception, which was based actually on an article I wrote in 1980 for the Journal of Orthomolecular Psychiatry. It was published in the journal, and that was following 2 years of studies that we did with the kids at Salem, based at Salem, based on the work of Ben Feingold. The hypothesis that I put forward in that book is that in a hunting-gathering society, which is where we all started. In a hunting-gathering society, those three characteristics are not liabilities, they're assets. If you're a hunter and you're going through the forest, you need to be noticing everything around you all the time. Because if you fail to notice that little flash of light over there that's the rabbit, you may miss lunch. Or you may miss the week's food and you may starve. And if you fail to miss that flash of light over your left shoulder that's the bear coming up on you, you may become its lunch. So distractibility would be an asset. And in fact, one of the ways that the psychological profession, and I was on the roster of psychotherapists in Vermont for a number of years, so I don't think speaking out of school. The way that the psychotherapeutic profession has justified distractibility as being a pathology, as they say, if you take a distractible child and you put him in a very, very boring environment, he becomes more distractible. And in fact, it's true. But, you know, think about it. If you're going through the forest and you don't see anything to eat and you're supposed to be looking for lunch, you need to be scanning even more. That's that distractibility, a scanning behavior. So number one, distractibility. I call it scanning, and I think it's a good thing in a hunting-gathering world. And and we'll get to in just a second how that applies to adults and children today. Number two, impulsivity. If you're chasing a rabbit through the forest and a deer goes by, you don't have time to pull out a pad and a pen and say, let's do a risk-benefit analysis. Let's carefully consider this. Let's see. On the left side, we've got the rabbit. On the right side, we've got the deer. On the left side, rabbit, easier to catch. On the other hand, liability, less meat. Now, on the other side, deer, harder to catch, but more meat. By the time they're both gone by that time. Right? Instead, you'd have to make an instantaneous decision and, in fact, be following through on that decision, pulling the bow and arrow or throwing the spear or firing the gun or whatever it may be, before you even realize that you've thought it out. Behavior preceding cognition, or at least the knowledge of cognition, the knowledge of thinking. That's the dictionary definition of impulsivity. It would be a good thing in that world. And the third diagnostic criteria for ADHD, risk-taking behavior, need for high levels of arousal. The person who wakes up in the morning and says, in a hunting-gathering world, and says, you know, there's lions and tigers and bears out there. I'm not going to go out there. There's things that want to eat me as much as I want to eat them. I'm afraid of taking risks. That person would starve. But the person who says, hey, there's things out there that want to eat me as much as I want to eat them. I'm going to go out and find lunch. That person's going to be very successful. Now, once agriculture came along, everything changed. Agriculture and the Industrial Revolution, now we value, you know, picking bugs off plants hour after hour after hour. You have to have a lot of focus, and you can't be impulsive. And there's no risk involved. I mean, the land is all fenced in. So all of these behaviors that would make a person as an adult a great cop or a great test pilot or a great author or a great investigative journalist or a great talk show host, I'm telling you, you find this ADD throughout the media, or there's so many other areas, a great investigative scientist that would make people so good in so many areas, makes them lousy as bookkeepers, makes them lousy as bureaucrats, makes them lousy at the farmer occupations, as it were. And so I'm suggesting that this is ADHD specifically is a context disorder. And the solution is not to change the neurochemistry of our children or adults. The solution is to change the environment, to make our schools more stimulating for kids who need stimulation, to make the workplace more stimulating for or help people find careers, appropriate careers, where they actually get that stimulation so they don't need to take the stimulant drugs. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Back 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And I just want to be on record as saying I'm not opposed to medications or to drugs in general. In fact, the fact of the matter is I'm medicated right now. I'm on my second cup. Actually, I had a cup of coffee earlier, and I'm on my second cup of caffeine, my first cup of Earl Grey tea. So, you know, I probably got 300 milligrams of caffeine in me, as you might be able to tell. And last night, I'm on the board of our community association, our floating home community, and we had a board meeting, and I took some drugs then, too. I had a glass of wine after the meeting was over, and we were sitting around talking with our neighbors. I'm not opposed to medication. I'm not opposed to pharmaceuticals. I'm not opposed to even stimulant medication for people with ADHD. I have seen it save some people's lives. Yeah, I've seen it really turn some people around. What I'm saying is, as a society, we need to ask ourselves, have we reached a point where we're over-relying on this? Because fundamentally, particularly with our schools, the question is, do we change our school to make it more friendly to our kids? And I saw this, by the way, when I was in Taiwan. I just saw an amazing school there. The teacher got up and she explained in about 5 minutes, this is a class of about 50 kids, explain about 5 minutes the topic. And you can explain anything in 5 minutes, you know, long division, quadratic equations, whatever. You can explain it in five. Doesn't mean everybody's going to understand it. She explained it, you know, on the board. And then she asked, who understands this in the classroom? And about 4 or 5 kids out of 40 or 50 stood up. And then she sat down and she said, now you teach them. And those kids that were standing had the kids around them form into groups. And as the kids who were sitting got it, they stood up and participated in the teaching with the kids who were standing, and you could see learning moving across that classroom like a wave until every kid in the class was standing at the end of the hour. Every kid in the class got it, and the teacher walked around as a consultant, essentially, to the kids who were teaching. This is called peer instruction, and it really works. So the question is, are we going to change our schools in a way that meets the needs of all of our children, which that, for example, does? It's the old one-room schoolhouse model, frankly. Or are we going to take a drug and put it into the brains of kids and modify their brains? By the way, this is such good news. A pigeon alert! The Vatican's chief astronomer says that believing in aliens does not contradict faith in God. See, I'm telling you, those pigeons, they're from the planet Xenu, and they are spies. They're actually robots, but they were made by aliens. The Reverend Jose Gabriel Fuentes, the Jesuit director of the Vatican Observatory, says that the vastness of the universe means it is possible that there could be other forms of life outside Earth, even intelligent ones. This was published Tuesday in the Vatican's newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano. He says that such a notion of aliens doesn't contradict our faith, because aliens would also be God's creatures. In fact, the headline of the article was titled, "The Extraterrestrial is My Brother." And he said to not believe in the possibility of the existence of aliens would be like putting limits on God's creative freedom. So, there. To all you pigeon skeptics, and we now have, by the way, pigeon icons in the chat room. Every now and then the pigeons show up there listening. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
Hi. There's a common malady that's exploited by the drug companies, acid reflux, which I got the symptoms of. And I went to my allopathic doctor and got prescribed the purple pill for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that, so I went to another physician in my town who is trained at Duke and also an Ayurvedic doctor. And I took bitters, slippery elm, licorice, ginger, and hydrochloric acid, which is actually stomach acid.
Right.
And it went away.
Yeah. And that, and the other thing that's a big one with acid reflux is posture and walking. A lot of people, if they just start standing up straight and they walk more frequently, then the esophagus, you know, the stomach stays below the abdominal. I forget the name of the where it passes through that muscle at the base of the lungs, and I'm forgetting all my anatomy now.
In any case,
yeah, it is a sphincter actually, but it's in any case the diaphragmatic sphincter.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes the part of the stomach will get up above that too, and then you get the acid going up there, and that's more easily solved by simply good posture and walking and things like that. So you're spot on, Jackie. There's so many ways to solve so many of these problems that are not considered because, hey, let's give them drugs first. Obsidian in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Obsidian.
Hi, Tom. One, at least I'm glad to know I can actually believe in myself, even though I might be an ET or non-ET or whatever.
There you go.
So, well, hey, to some other intelligent being in another planet, in another galaxy, hey, that's good to know,
Yeah,
but
is.
Anyway, to the point of your talk and all that, one, it's no doubt in my mind as to the reason why the pharmaceuticals are slowing down the younger generation, such as kids that are under teenage, as well as adult age, because a lot of the kids are generally the starseed kids, starseed adults and whatnot. And the information where this comes from, that you can research at your leisure, is by a Dr. Boylan. He has a site online.
Go ahead.
Pardon?
Go ahead. You were going to give a website. Go ahead.
Okay. drboylan.com.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the theory, and there's a whole variety of these obsidian that kind of tie together that these are special kids and that this is a special time and that old souls are coming to Earth and all these sorts of things. And, it may be. I honestly don't know. I suspect my personal take on it is that it's the confluence of a culture that is rapidly changing. And I think that other cultures have seen this, Mayan cultures, Native American cultures. It's a confluence of a culture that's rapidly changing, technology that's changing, and kids being born into this time of change and adapting to it. But I don't know. I can't say that I absolutely know, so I'm not going to try. Let's see. Gene in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi. I was hoping that at some point you could have on Christopher Bryson with his book, The Fluoride Deception.
Here in Portland, there's a local dentist who is very outspoken about this. We're one of the few major cities in the United States that does not fluoridate our water supply. And there is always the campaign to put fluoride in the water supply. And it's a hot topic. It's a very hot topic, Gene. And whether fluoride is a carcinogen or whether it's a poison or not. Apparently it is a waste product from refining aluminum. And so it's very, it used to be that they used to have to spend a lot of money to dispose of the stuff. Now they just put it in the water supply. Whether that is good for us or bad for us, I honestly don't know. It's not, I haven't researched that the way I have attention deficit disorder, so I can't say. But it's an interesting topic, and yeah, you're right. We should bring it up sometime, get some experts on. Noodles in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Noodles.
Hey, Tom, what's going on? Love the show today.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if you've ever seen a movie called THX 1138.
I have
not. By George Lucas.
I have not. By George Lucas.
Yeah, it's one of his first movies that he ever did is in made in the late 60s. Uh-huh. And it's literally about a society of people that live underground, and it's illegal for them not to take the drugs that basically the government prescribes to them.
Well, you know, and this is, we're sort of there. This is an article from the Washington Post. I'll just read you the first sentence. The U.S. government has injected hundreds of foreigners it has deported with dangerous psychotropic drugs against their will to keep them sedated during the trip back to their home country, according to medical records, internal documents, and interviews with people who have been drugged. We're forcing people to take drugs.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, and these are not folks who are being medicated because, you know, hey, they're potentially harmful to themselves or others. These are folks who are being medicated because it's easier to transport them that way. And I think that that's a huge line that we've stepped over as a society, and not a good one, not a healthy one. Mike in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi. I like your analysis. I've had ADHD, if you want to call it that, and have read your book, Hunter and Gatherer. But as far as depression and some of the other ailments that people are suffering, using your theory, I think that people just haven't been able to change as fast as the industrialized time period in this country or in the world. Things were moving slow during, for the last 10,000 years, and then all of a sudden thrust upon the psyche of a human being where with the work schedule and the responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And
the tyranny of choice that we talked about yesterday, the million options and all those other things. Mike, I think you raise a really important point, and let me just riff on that for a second. There is, and thanks for the call. There was a study, this is over 20 years ago, that was done, as I recall, in Kenya, where they went in and they said, okay, chimpanzees, about 5%, 5 to 15% of chimpanzees experience clinical depression the same as humans, where they disengage, they become socially disengaged, they don't eat, they don't sleep well, they withdraw to the perimeter of society. Let's go into a chimpanzee troop and dart out, you know, take out those chimps, not kill them, but hit them with a tranquilizer gun and remove them. Remove the depressed chimps. Let's pull them out and see what happens. They did this. And over a six-month period, or maybe it was a year, as I recall, 6 months or a year in any case, what happened was the entire chimpanzee troop died. Why? Because the depressed ones, and they were taking turns being depressed, by the way, just like humans do. In other words, it was episodic. Because the depressed ones, because they were hypervigilant, because they weren't sleeping, because they had socially disengaged and put themselves around the periphery of the community, they were the ones who were sounding the alert. They were the ones who saw the python coming through the tree. They were the ones who first noticed the lion that was stalking the troop. They were the ones who saw danger. And the scientist, one of the scientists who did this study, concluded the study by saying, perhaps the depressives among us, the Ernest Hemingways, the Albert Camus, waving the flag saying, hey, wait a minute. Maybe they are our early warning system.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
And Sean Taylor, our producer, is keeping an eye on the comments for today's show over at TomHartman.com to decide who's going to get an autographed copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, my most recent book in bookstores now, in fine bookstores all across the country. And in fact, we will be signing that, along with hopefully other of my books, at Frugal Muse Books at 7 p.m., corner of the southeast corner of 75th and Lamont Road in Darien. And Louise has confirmed, yes, I will be giving a talk there. It won't be the whole hour rant that I'll be doing at the Green Festival, which will actually be on another topic on Saturday. It will probably be about a half hour, and then we'll be signing books and stuff. So be sure and drop by. It should be a lot of fun. Ellen Ratner is with us. I'm going to take one quick call here before we get to that, and because Mike in Burien has been waiting. Mike, a quick comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, basically, Tom, getting back to the children's ADD problem and drugging them down, I think I've heard you talk before about corn syrup.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think first, a dietitian should maybe take over first.
Yeah. Yeah. And, very, very well said. Yeah. And corn syrup is in my opinion, is a toxin. I just, you know, I can't tell you how many people I know who've taken corn syrup out of their diet and they lose weight and their brain works better. By the way, there's a book out called, The Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy from Chelsea Green by Bruce Levine. And, thanks, a tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room for this. And he points out in his book that in several studies done in the United States, the average psychiatrist is diagnosing depression in less than 10 minutes. Less than 3 minutes in many cases. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with our daily report of what's actually going on in the world. Hey, Ellen.
Well, we're going to start out the United Nations and go down to Washington. At the United Nations, John Holmes did the briefing on Myanmar, Burma, and he said that, is this incredible, Tom? The Secretary General has not been able to reach the general who was in charge of Myanmar, Burma, who's head of the junta,
yeah.
And for over 2 days.
I think they're hiding a genocide, Ellen. I think what that thing that you said was kind of the buzz. It makes so much sense that that's what's going on, is that Burma has been engaged, has done a Pol Pot, and they don't want the world to know.
Something's going on. They are saying that they are letting aid in, but they have increased, apparently, the people at various checkpoints to make sure that there are no foreigners involved. They are allowing relief workers from neighboring four countries, but not United Nations workers, et cetera.
Not good.
In the Senate, they are trying to get a collective bargaining bill for police, firemen, et cetera, and they want to attach, apparently McCain has his own alternative GI bill. They're trying to attach that, which would effectively kill the bill because, of course, if they can attach it, the Republicans, the Democrats don't want to vote for this GI bill, then that would effectively kill the collective bargaining bill.
And then, And then both groups get to say that the other group didn't vote for the GI Bill, and we're just playing politics here.
Absolutely.
It's such a shame that John McCain won't just say, Jim Webb did a good job, even though he's a Democrat. It's a good piece of legislation, the new GI Bill. We're going to sign on to it, and we're not going to come up with our own, and we're not going to use it to kill other pieces of legislation. That's tragic.
It is tragic. The president is Israel. He met with both Olmert and Shimon Peres, who is now the president of Israel. And in the Olmert meeting, his remarks, the president talked about making sure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. So he cannot keep away from the Iran word. There was also a rocket from Gaza, which hit an Israeli shopping center. And the president talked about Israel being a prosperous, hopeful land and a beacon of democracy.
Now, 3 days ago, or perhaps it was 2 days ago, Keith Olbermann reported on Countdown, on his brilliant evening news show, that there was this big thing that was hyped by the Pentagon, that they were going to show 20,000 pieces of evidence, pieces of munitions and whatnot that could be tracked back to Iran to prove that Iran was responsible for killing Americans. And the press showed up, and when they showed up and they trotted all this stuff out, it turned out that they couldn't find made in Iran on any of it. In fact, none of it was made in Iran. Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar with that. That actually, that happened at the Pentagon. As I understand it from our Pentagon correspondent, Meredith McKenzie, that a report did come out, and they were not able to track a majority of it. I think they found some, but nothing really significant.
The only guy who reported this story was Keith Olbermann. This seems like, you know, Bush is running around going, we got to bomb Iran, and everybody covers it. When the military finally is forced to admit, no, we have no evidence, nobody covers it. What's going on?
I don't know what's going on. We actually did talk about it on some of our shows.
Yeah.
I don't know why we didn't talk about it on yours. But
I mean, MSNBC,
but
I mean, ABC, CBS, NBC, you know, the big networks. It's not right. Like it's a big story.
Exactly. And what's, I mean, interesting about all of that, Tom, is that, in fact, they don't have the proof, and yet the president is still pushing everywhere he goes on Iran.
Right, and the other thing is every time I see Iran's nuclear program, I see that phrase constantly in the media. You know, another story in the Washington Post yesterday, they should be saying Iran's nuclear energy program or nuclear electricity program, because that's what it is. That's how the Iranians refer to it. That's how most of the European press refers to it. The American press always leaves the impression that it's a nuclear bomb program.
Right, and there is no evidence at this point.
No, there's no evidence that they've enriched beyond 3.5%. You've got to enrich to 90% or greater to make bombs. So, anyway.
And let me just, as long as we are on the press, I did want to point out a story which I'm sure you have seen. I don't know if you've talked about it or not, but it just makes me crazy. Washington Post has been doing a full bunch of stories on the Immigration Naturalization Service and health care for detainees. Well, it turns out they did a 5,000-word story today talking about how detainees, when they're being deported, are being given, not all of them, illegal drugs, Haldol and other tranquilizer drugs,
right,
by injection.
You're right, yeah. Serious prescription drugs to knock them down, basically, so they can more easily turn. Yeah, we did mention that, and it's a big story. It's on the front page of the Washington Post today. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
The smart people get their news.
Well, you know, sometimes... Welcome back, by the way. Sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes you know what you don't know. Sometimes what you don't know, you do know. Sometimes even everything, as the Fireside Theater says, you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible? Audacia Ray edits the Village Voice sexuality blog Naked City, produces the weekly video show Naked City TV. She's the author of Naked on the Internet, Hookups, Downloads, and Cashing In on Internet Sexploration, and the award-winning director and producer of the porn feature The Buy Apple. She's a former sex worker who is an executive editor at Spread Magazine for 3 years and is now on the board of advocacy organization Sex Work Awareness, for which she edits the public education blog Sex Work 101, and her website is WakingVixen.com. A nerdy, naughty girl is how you describe yourself on your Audacia. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start out by making a distinction that I think it's really important to make at the beginning of this kind of a conversation, mm-hmm. and that is that the trafficking of women and children for purposes of sex, which is a major industry in the world, as well as in the United States, the trafficking of women and children is something that we all universally deplore. That's the real exploitation, and I'm assuming young boys and men as well, for sexual purposes, but principally women and children. Something that is appropriately illegal is, and you know, we're just this is not about that at all. Okay. So what we're talking about are people who, consensual adults, who decide to enter into sexual relationships that may involve money and that certainly are not, you know, necessarily for the purpose of marriage or producing children.
Right. But it's also important to define what sexual relationships mean, because, I mean, I use the phrase sex worker a lot in applying to what you just described.
Mm-hmm.
And sex worker is basically an umbrella term for people who work in the sex industry. And it doesn't necessarily always include people who are having intercourse for money.
Right.
So a sex worker could be a phone sex worker. They could be a porn performer. They could be a dancer in a strip club. They could do any number of things that don't necessarily include.
They could be somebody talking on the telephone.
Right, yeah.
I mean,
so,
that's a major
yeah,
part of the industry.
They could come in contact with someone. They could have a monogamous relationship, all those things. So there are many different varieties of sex worker, and that's an important thing to remember, too, because often sex worker is sort of used as a euphemism for prostitute.
I remember the first time that I went to Amsterdam, you know, walking down one of the streets there and seeing the women standing in the doors, you know, in the glass windows rather, and just you know the moment of culture shock. I was in my 20s, and it was so different from the prudish America in the Midwest that I'd grown up in, and much of the rest of the world has a very different perspective on sex workers than America and England. It seems like we got the Queen Victoria mental disease.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, a month and change ago when the Spitzer scandal broke, I did an interview with a Portuguese television station, and the first question they had for me kind of off camera was, why is this such a big deal?
Well, this is how America reacted to the Bill Clinton impeachment.
Yeah.
You know, when Jacques Chirac, I believe, I'm mixing up my French presidents, but one of the French presidents died, and the other one went to his funeral with his wife on one arm and his mistress on the other.
Yep.
And it was right there on the front cover of Le Monde and covered by French television, and nobody thought three things about it.
Right.
I mean, what is the state of the organization of sex workers in America today? I mean, should there be a union, or is that just asking for more attention from people like John Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez, who seem to be hysterical about this stuff?
I don't think that's necessarily asking for trouble to build unions, but the industry is so huge and so varied, and people within the industry have many different kinds of needs that I don't necessarily think would be perfectly served by one union.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a really big issue, that people in different sects of the industry have different needs. So,
but there is this group Coyote that's been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, no, there are a couple of groups that have been around for a long time. Coyote stands for Call Off Your Old Tired Ethics.
Right.
There's also an organization here in New York called Pony, which is Prostitutes of New York, that's been around for about 30 years. So there are organizations that have existed a while. The phrase sex work was actually sort of conceived in the mid to late 70s and has since become much more widely used. So that's sort of the birth of the contemporary sex worker rights movement. It's been kind of turning around for about 30 years. But I think the Internet has really revolutionized the activism that's been going around because there's a bigger support system now. You know, you can subscribe to lots of different news feeds and newsletters about these issues and connect with people who have similar experiences around the country and around the world. And I think that's something that's been really powerful for a lot of people who are interested in sex work advocacy. But on the other hand, it is very, very difficult to organize sex workers because of the risk and the stigma involved. For instance, last night I was talking to this woman who is currently a sex worker. She does sensual massage, and she was, you know, very politically passionate, but was very adamant, saying that she cannot touch the sex worker rights movement until she's retired, because the risk that it would put her in, and the public visibility and all those things would be not just bad for business, but potentially legally problematic.
Could get her thrown in jail. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking with Audacia Ray, by the way. WakingVixen.com is her website. Audacia, yesterday we did an hour on this show about the millennial generation and, you know, this young generation that's coming up, and we didn't so much get into the confluence of the libertarian movement and the whole Ron Paul phenomena and everything and that generation, but it's there. What's happening is that, you know, I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. You know, they don't think that we should have Social Security, but they do think that prostitution should be decriminalized and drugs as well. And it seems that the younger generation that's coming up is the most libertarian in that regard, at least. Are you sensing that the attitudes of America are changing? And do you think that this is something that's cyclical, that just like goes around every 80 years? Or is this linear? Is there a progressive change?
I think there is definitely a shift. But I think what's important to talk about is the kind of difference between public advocacy and private agreement. And that's something that's mm-hmm. really powerful when it comes to sexuality. For instance, there's a book that came out recently that's by Brian Alexander that's called America Unzipped. And it's sort of his journey through the sexual underbelly of America. And one of the things that he realizes is that he talks to a lot of people who are politically very conservative but want the freedom to do what they want to do privately and fully believe that they should be able to do whatever they want behind closed doors. And that's a really, really powerful sentiment that I think is very pervasive throughout the United States.
Yeah.
However, there's a big gap between being able, you know, saying I want to be able to look at porn and buy and use sex toys within the privacy of my own home, and the gap between that and then stepping out and saying this is something I believe in enough to stand up and speak out about and, you know, talk to the press or, you know, talk to my local politicians and stuff like that. That's a huge jump for most people, and one that most people are not willing to make at all because there's so much stigma attached, and it's such a high-risk thing to do.
Prostitution is legal in parts of Nevada, excuse me.
Right.
Is that, you know, I recall a news story recently that there was a lot of pushback against that, and then I've seen other news stories that that Las Vegas is considering decriminalizing prostitution in its own city limits. What's the state of prostitution, legal prostitution in the United States? We have about a half a minute here before we have to wrap this up.
Well, there's a difference between legalization and decriminalization. Legalization, as it is in Nevada, is typified with lots of regulation by the state, whereas decriminalization promotes more independent workers and their independent rights, so they don't work for a brothel or for an agency. And that's a really key distinction.
And are either growing or diminishing?
I think people are still having trouble understanding the difference. So they're both growing.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Daisha Ray, our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, her website, WakingVixen.com. You can learn all about all the work that she's doing, and fascinating talking with you, Daisha. Thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me.
It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Speaking of sin, the Vatican has added 7 mortal sins. I'll tell you about it right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Learning to fly, maybe you should talk to the robotic pigeons. Or is that about going to heaven? What's the metaphor here? Well, the Vatican, interestingly, has apparently, there is some dispute of this. It's interesting, the entry over at Wikipedia about the seven mortal sins actually has this debate going on. But this from the BBC. The original 7 sins, of course, the mortal sins, and a mortal sin, by the way, is defined as the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that, quote, immediately after death, the souls of those who die in a state of mortal sin descend into hell, end of quote. And the original 7 deadly sins, pride, envy, gluttony, lust, anger, greed, and sloth. Well, recently, Archbishop Gianfranco Gerotti, at the end of a week-long training seminar in Rome for priests, I'm quoting from the BBC, an article by David Wiley for the BBC News out of Rome, aimed at encouraging a revival of the practice of confession of the sacrament of penance in church jargon, this laid out a new list of mortal sins. The new mortal sins were listed by him at the end of the seminar. The Vatican has brought up to date the traditional 7 deadly sins by adding 7 modern mortal sins. It claims are becoming prevalent in what it calls an area of unstoppable globalization. And here, and by the way, back in 1998, I think it was, I was invited by Pope John Paul II, or actually by a person on his staff, you know, to come over to, Louise and I were invited to come over to Castle Gandolfo, which is the Pope's summer residence, for a private audience with the Pope as a result of the fellow on his staff having read one of a book that I wrote, a book called The Prophet's Way. And we it was amazing. I mean, you know, we were just sitting at home one day and the fax machine lights up and out comes this fax, you know, saying you're invited for a private audience with His Holiness Pope John Paul II. This is a joke. You know, I mean, who's pulling my leg here? But it turned out it was real. And, in fact, originally when we went, Louise was given this long list, I mean, literally a long list of what she couldn't wear. And there was nothing for me about what I couldn't wear. And she was not supposed to meet the Pope, and I was supposed to. But when we got there, we spent about 2 hours, 3 hours at this concert, and then afterwards there were about 30 people who had these little private, it's called a private audience, it's really about a 3-minute, very brief conversation and photo opportunity. And you can find a picture of me and the Pope over at my website at tomhartman.com. He agreed as we were there, after we talked and he shook my hand, he turned to Louise and spoke with her and shook her hand. Being Protestants, we didn't kiss his ring, but that was, you know, fine with him. I mean, that was the protocol. But I started following what he was saying. I really became a fan of Pope John Paul II. I think that he was one of the deep thinkers of our time and one of the more profound moralists of our time. And he strongly opposed George Bush's invasion of Iraq. He strongly opposed capital punishment. When Bush executed a mentally retarded child in Texas, Pope John Paul II lobbied very hard, personally lobbied to try and stop that, was unsuccessful. George W. Bush murdered him anyway, killed him, executed him anyway. So anyhow, I've always had a lot of respect for him, and not having grown up Catholic, I don't claim great knowledge of the Church, but Pope John Paul II, I read his autobiography, which I thought was fascinating. So all of that said, I think that most of these things are consistent with his worldview, which I have tremendous respect for. The modern evils, the new seven sins, consider this. Environmental pollution, genetic manipulation, accumulating excessive wealth. Now, these are now mortal sins. Go directly to hell. Do not pass go. Do not get $200. Inflicting poverty, drug trafficking and consumption, morally debatable experiments, and violation of fundamental rights of human nature. Now, I'm assuming that means violations of human rights. It may mean that they're opposed to gay sex. I'm not sure because the way it's written, it's a little ambiguous, but I'm assuming that it is, you know, violating human rights. This is incredible. Pollution, genetic accumulating excessive wealth, inflicting poverty. Yes. I mean, these are the things, you know, in Matthew, what is it, Matthew 21, as I recall, or 22, the disciples came to Jesus and they said, you know, how do we get to heaven? And he said, you know, well, in the last days, I'm going to be sitting there choosing between the sheep and the goats, you know, those who go to heaven, those who go to hell. And I'll say, you know, those guys, those of you who fed me when I was hungry, come on with me. Those of you who gave me a drink when I was thirsty, come on with me. Those of you who visited me when I was in prison, come on with me. Those of you who clothed me when I was naked, you know, basically healed me when I was sick. And the disciples are freaked out. They're saying, hey, wait a minute. We never saw you hungry. We never saw you sick. How can we get into heaven if it? And he says, as you did unto the least of these, my brethren, you did unto me. And this is the Catholic Church, you know, putting this into policy, I guess. Anyway, and for the last century, at the least, and arguably for most of its history, but certainly over the last century, I'd say the Catholic Church in many ways has been at the forefront of activism on these kinds of issues. And, you know, I think it's a marvelous thing, and I just want to highlight this and say, good on you. Caught you doing something right. By the way, Sean is looking at our message board or at our homepage for our contest.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270.
Is the last man standing?
24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, teamsters.org. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. And Carol Lee, listening on Green 960 in San Francisco. Hey, Carol Lee, what's up?
Hi, I'm so glad that you took my call, Tom. I'm a longtime listener.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your patience. What's up?
Well, you know, I actually originally coined the term sex work in 1978.
You did?
I did. It was in my book, and Oxford English Dictionary gave me the credit for it.
Wow. What's your book?
Unrepentant Whore, Collected Work of Scarlet Harlot.
Amazing. That's
well, and you know, I wanted to revisit the issue of trafficking and prostitution because you know mm-hmm. there's a bill in the Senate that's addressing it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, of course, as you know, you mentioned the sex worker rights advocates are opposed to forced prostitution and slavery, but the problem is that historically these things have been conflated.
Yes.
And you know, from a rights perspective, trafficking, which had been called white slavery, was used as an excuse to increase the criminalization.
Yes, of consensual sex.
Correct. Yeah. So at this point, I don't know if you've been keeping track of H.R. 3887, but it's just about to be signed into law in the Senate. I think they may be actually dismantling that conflation, but the House version did actually conflate sex trafficking and slavery. And I think that it's a very important issue in sex worker rights. And internationally, it's sort of at the crux of the issues in terms
so,
of rights.
So what the legislation does, if I understand what you're saying correctly, is that it draws into the same criminal net with forced prostitution, with sex trafficking, consensual prostitution.
Yes, it actually adds the category of sex trafficking to the Mann Act, if you're familiar with that.
Right, and the Mann Act is the law that makes prostitution illegal, is it not?
Right. And wasn't Charlie Chaplin was I think a famous boxer was charged that was used in problematic ways historically.
Right. Interesting. Carol Lee, thank you for giving us the heads up on that. I'll have to dig into that a little more.
I'll send you an email.
Great. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
My contact information is right on our website. Thank you, Carol Lee. Good to hear from you. Good on you for writing a book. Jasmine in Alameda, California. Hey, Jasmine.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about Burma.
Mm-hmm.
I've been following Burma since 1983 when I worked with somebody from Burma who was Muslim. And even back then, the Burmese government was going in and just murdering villagers.
Yeah.
Sort of an annual thing.
Oh, I saw the same thing in 96 or 97. I was in Chiang Mai speaking at a conference and was invited to go out and visit a Karen, K-A-R-I-N, I think it is spelled, refugee camp. And the Karen are the people of Western Burma, the indigenous people, who are being murdered, slaughtered by the government. And there are all these refugee camps on the eastern border between Thailand and Burma, where these refugees are coming, and it was just a god-awful mess there. It was a terrible problem.
Yeah, as I understand it, it's primarily non-Burman, non-ethnic Burman people they're targeted.
Right.
Also religious minorities.
Yep.
And many of your minorities are trying to do separatist movements, which makes them targeted also.
Yeah, which included the Karen. Yeah.
For the past several years, there are entire villages that have been on the move that the Burmese government forces the aid worker feeding camps to just move so that nobody can plant crops. I did do a blog on Burma right after the tsunami because there was absolutely no word about Burma in the news under net-traveler.blogspot.com.
Okay.
And at the time that I did it, it was because there was no news. I just posted a bunch of links and, you know, spent a week researching in order to put it together. At the time, I made the error of calling it a communist government. It's a totalitarian government.
Right. They call themselves communists, but Karl Marx would certainly not.
There's no distribution.
Yeah.
Their policy has been to put less than a dollar a year into health care for the people. The areas that are affected really have almost no development. The junta itself has, you know, wonderful golf courses and palaces and their own private roads. But the other thing is the Red Cross has mainly been working in the north near the Golden Triangle to do feeding to divert people from opium growing, because that's when opium and oil are the primary funding for the junta.
Right.
And in the south, it's been primarily World Vision. So in terms of infrastructure on the ground, World Vision is probably the most efficient way to get
World Vision, the Christian charity?
It's the Christian charity,
yeah.
But also Avaaz.org, which has been dealing with petitioning on Burma for years. They right now are doing a collection of money because they're going to distribute it directly to the Buddhist monks.
Do you, Jasmine, do you agree with my theory in this? You know, I'm looking back at the stories that I heard from the Karen people of slaughter. I mean, literally
absolutely.
Of slaughter.
Absolutely. It
that
has
what
been
this,
going
the, what, the,
on.
Yeah, that the reason that the junta is not allowing aid in is because they are trying to they're afraid that if aid workers get in there, they're going to find the kinds of piles of skulls that people found in Cambodia after Pol Pot died.
Well, that's only part of it, because it's going to be showing that it's been going on probably for at least 30 years.
Yep.
Not
and there's, and there's a lot of governments and a lot of companies that are complicit in it.
But there's another issue, and that is, you know, the extraction of resources. In my blog, if people look at it, they'll see that there was an organization that sued UNICAL on behalf of the Burmese people over the building of the Adana pipeline, which was UNICAL and Total of France. Halliburton was the primary contractors on that deal. And there was, you know, people were relocated, murdered, raped, put into slave labor. I believe the ultimate settlement was $1.4 billion, which was one of the reasons why UNICAL went on the block. Now, what's really interesting is early 2005, I read in the Los Angeles Times that the Chinese National Offshore Oil Company was interested in buying UNICAL. Well, the whole sale of UNICAL story wasn't even in the papers till June of 2005.
And that would bring it back to Burma again.
Exactly.
Because the Chinese are doing business with the Burmese.
And so
no problem
I was actually completely relieved that Chevron bought UNICAL.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really upsets me right now is when I see people, you know, trying to encourage other people to get Chevron to divest out of Burma, which I think is a terrible idea, and I will explain the two reasons why. Number one, the settlement of $1.4 billion. If you go onto the Chevron website, when they do their feely-good stuff of what they're doing for the people of Burma with building schools and hospitals, that's part of the settlement money.
So they're required by law to do
they're
it.
They're required by law. If they divest out of Burma, that aid is going to end.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Number two, if American company pulls out of Burma, then the Chinese are going to take over the Adana and Yetagun pipelines, which means that it's basically going to be one country doing a corporate takeover of another country.
Exactly. Jasmine, what you are describing is what we saw when we were in South Sudan last month, when Ellen Ratner and I and three other talk show hosts and my son went over to Southern Sudan, and we were right on the border with Darfur in a refugee camp with 45,000 refugees in one well and 300 miles from the nearest electricity. And, I mean, literally villages around us were being bombed while we were there. And we had about an hour-long meeting with Salva Kiir, the president of Southern Sudan and the vice president of all of Sudan. And he was quite explicit that he wanted American oil companies to come into South Sudan because of our embargo against oil coming out of Southern Sudan, only the Chinese were buying their oil, and the Chinese were arming the Northern Sudanese who were using these Chinese weapons to come down and bomb out the people in Southern Sudan, particularly in the areas that they wanted to clear for the oil fields.
Absolutely.
And this is why Steven Spielberg pulled out of the Olympics, was because China was doing this thing in Southern Sudan that is what you are describing would happen in Burma if Chevron pulled out. And it's really weird that progressives are in a position to say, let's not have an embargo against a country, but let's rather try to open it up, and let's even use American companies to the extent that it's possible to help open it up. I mean, it's totally weird, but when you get there and you see it on the ground, it's like, okay, I don't know what the alternative is other than doing this.
Well, there's a secondary security issue that most people haven't thought about, and that is the shipping lane between India and Burma. That if China were to have control of Burma, they would have control of that shipping lane.
Oh, my. And that's going to be a big deal to Japan. I mean, that's
exactly.
Like, you know, when we embargoed the Straits of Malacca, that's one of the things that provoked the Japanese to bomb Pearl Harbor. You know, it's, fascinating.
I would be inclined to encourage everyone to look up all the major oil and gas pipelines on the planet and put the names on their Yahoo or Google alerts.
Yeah.
Because when you hear about discoveries, generally within a few years, Civil War or some kind of atrocity.
Absolutely. Jasmine, we're out of time. What's your blog again?
net-traveler.blogspot.com.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank
I appreciate
you, Tom.
It. Yep. Thanks for calling in and sharing. That's amazing. We have the smartest listeners in the world on this program. I'm telling you, I am so pleased to be educated by so many of you every day. 45 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org coming up next.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees, the billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war.
9.5 minutes before the hour.
Mortal thunder.
Those wars almost always declared by civilians whose business interests will be enhanced.
Killing everything they say.
Welcome back. We have a winner in our contest today for the best entry on our daily show blog on our homepage at TomHartman.com. And Sean Taylor, our world-famous producer. Sean, what do we have?
We have, from Jack, a fortune cookie today. It says, man who stand in front of car get tired, but man who stand behind car get exhausted. And that sums up election fatigue from this marathon campaign season. He says he's sick of all the bickering and pandering. Choose your direction and floor it, America.
That's great. And the winner was, again?
Jack.
Jack. Okay, Jack wins
just
a copy
Jack.
Of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, Tom.
And Larry Scott is with us. He is the chief cook and bottle washer, editor, publisher, and all things extraordinary over at VAWatchdog.org. They're keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to, the premier veterans website out there. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
As always, I see so many things on your homepage I want to talk about, it from the lawsuit against the VA to Lou Dobbs calling impeachment an appropriate remedy to if Bush vetoes the GI Bill to the VA flip-flopping on voter registration, all these things. But let me let you sort them. What are the most important things for our listeners to know?
Well, let's talk about Senator John McCain and a couple of things here. First, the new GI Bill, which Senator Jim Webb of Virginia has put together. 57 senators supported, a huge number of members of the House supported. And they're just trying to get over the hump and get this thing voted on. John McCain stood in the way, would not endorse it or come on board. A couple of weeks ago, McCain offered his own extremely weak version, what he called a better version. The problem is the McCain people see a train wreck coming here. His version of the new GI Bill was so weak that they just can't get any support. So what's happening now is on Monday, Senator McCain wrote a letter to Senator Webb saying, well, why don't we compromise on this issue?
Hmm.
We don't quite know where that's going to go yet. We really haven't heard what's happening there. As far as I'm concerned, there is no compromise. Senator Webb's new GI Bill for our troops coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan is excellent. It pays for almost everything they would need to go to a four-year college. And we know the cost-benefit of the GI Bill. It is at least 7-1.
Yeah, the GI Bill back in the 50s, the 40s and the 50s, helped build the American middle class.
Exactly. It did exactly that. And we know it's at least 7-1. The people get better educated. They hold better jobs. They may start businesses. They pay more taxes. Basically, they give back more to the country. And if you just look at it from a dollar standpoint, it is at least $7 for every dollar put in. So McCain is being very short-sighted on this, and it has turned into such an ugly fight. Senator Patty Murray of Washington just a few minutes ago released a statement screaming that the GI Bill has been hijacked by partisanship and going on to lambaste Republicans. She said it's one of the lowest moves I've seen in my time in the Senate because they can't get a vote going on this.
And Patty Murray is generally relatively soft-spoken. I mean, she takes strong positions and she knows how to take names and kick butt. But for her to say something that's with language that strong, that she's really got to be furious.
She is really angry about this. So we have to keep an eye on this new GI Bill. And of course, you mentioned Lou Dobbs. The interesting thing is, if this new GI Bill passes, President Bush has threatened to veto it. Last Friday, Lou Dobbs did an excellent piece, an investigative piece on the GI Bill, who's for it, who's against it, why it stalled. And at the end of that piece, he said that if President Bush vetoes the new GI Bill, then impeachment is an appropriate remedy because it will be just one more time that this administration has let down the troops and the veterans of this country. That is pretty strong language. Of course, we know Lou does like to get a headline now and then.
Yeah, but this is a guy who, up until about 3 years ago, proudly proclaimed that he was a Republican at every opportunity.
Right. And now he is just intent on getting this new GI Bill through. And when you say impeachment, that is pretty strong language, even coming from someone like Lou Dobbs. If we stay on the McCain thread, earlier this year, John McCain said he promised veterans, if elected, he would give them a VA card. This card they could take anywhere they wanted to a private provider, and the government would pay for their health care no matter what. Veterans groups went up in arms, said, "You've got to be kidding. First of all, you dismantle the VA, then you privatize the entire system. The cost would be overwhelming. The same services cost anywhere between 25% and 50% more going out to privatize the VA."
Sure. Because somebody's got to make a profit on it. The VA is a not-for-profit organization.
So now the union that represents many VA workers, the AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, has said enough is enough. And they've launched a nationwide radio ad campaign going directly after Senator McCain's VA card proposal. What they're saying is, don't listen to this. If we fully fund and mandatorily fund VA health care, we will eliminate the problems that the VA has now because they won't be underfunded, they won't be understaffed, and this whole concept of a VA card is just another way to privatize the system, to put all of this money into the hands of big business, and it won't work. So expect those AFGE ads in your neighborhood soon.
And the simple solution is to just remove the VA from the discretionary part of the budget.
Which is right. And unfortunately, I hate to say this, but our Democratic folks up on Capitol Hill have put this on the back burner. For years, they screamed about mandatory funding. Let's mandatorily fund it. We come up with an equation. It's based on need. That formula works. And the VA healthcare system gets the money they need every year. Now it's languishing in committee. They're talking about fiduciary responsibility and code words like that. So we've really got to push the Democrats to get that going.
There you go. And we'll do it. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Larry, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up tomorrow, Jeffrey Feldman about how conservatives' use of violent language is poisoning democracy in America. And Douglas Farah is going to talk about how the man behind supplying weapons to both sides in the war on terror. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.